Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
How has coaching evolved in the modern era? Why do coaches struggle with better teaching concepts? Do these new techniques actually work and why? The only question left is, say it with me, you in? Hey, sports fans, Coach Nick here, and welcome to the B-Ball Breakdown Podcast. Today, I'm pleased to welcome on the show Ben Guest, who is a teacher and a university lecturer with a PhD in educational leadership. But really why I wanted to bring him on the show was because he's written a book called Zen and the Art of Coaching Basketball, which touches upon his experiences as a former high school coach in Mississippi and also a professional coach overseas. So, Ben, thanks for coming on the show.
Nick, so happy to be on. Big fan, longtime listener, as they say. So
first time caller.
To be on.
Nice.
Yep.
Well, you know, you had emailed me the book and you had asked me to maybe even write a blurb, which I would still need to do, by the way. I hope maybe you can shove it on Amazon if it's possible to update it at some point, because I have thoughts. I have blurbs to give you, because it really, you know, here's the thing. Sometimes you come across a book, particularly with sports writing, that really does a great job putting you in the scenes. Not everybody's good at that. Not everyone can capture that. But every so often you come across some writing. And so I wanted to really commend you, maybe even ask you for some insight in what your process was and in allowing us to like get into the scene so perfectly and so well and be able to picture it as vividly as we do when we're reading it.
Sure, 100%. Number one, thank you for the compliment. That's a great compliment. And two, before I address that, just with the idea of a blurb and updating. So I self-published this book on Amazon, and it's available in ebook, paperback, and hardcover. So for anybody out there that's interested in writing and publishing, it's incredibly easy to do on Amazon. And of course, one of the things you can do is constantly update any aspect of the book. So yes, as soon as I get Coach Nick's blurb, the next day it'll be officially in the manuscript, and then Amazon, every edition that's printed after that will automatically reflect that. So I was an English teacher, high school English teacher, for several years, and everything you're saying is just a great compliment, because great writing, descriptive writing, should put you in the scene. And so often when people tell stories about something that already happened, they speak in generalities. So the key is really, what are the sounds? What are the smells? What are the visuals? What's the feeling? And all of that hopefully then connects an emotion from the writer to the reader. And that's really what writing and most of art is, I think. It's the one person trying to transmit an emotional experience to another person. So using those specifics of image and sound and smell and touch and feeling hopefully transmits that emotion.
Well, let's get into some of the meat and bones or meat and potatoes of the book, because I think what it's really about is the transformation of a coach from what we had been taught and learned and how to coach for, you know, 100 years up until recently and then now. Although arguably, you know, if we have to use the title is referencing, you know, sort of a Phil Jackson approach to coaching, and he'll obviously looms large in this discussion. You know, he had been doing these things since the 80s, way back in the CBA. And I think only now, you know, 30, 40 years on, is it kind of catching on to some sort of a mainstream approach. Certainly, I've been trying to advocate that. So when I see somebody else make that realization and able to describe it, it gets me really excited, because I think it's time to have these conversations and maybe thaw some of these coaches out who have been so dogmatic in their approach to what they believe is how, you know, communication should go. So just describe for us in the beginning, like where you came from, what your background was, and what was modeled for you as a coach, and what you thought needed to be the way coaching would happen on the basketball court.
Right. I was, can we curse on here, coach, or no? So I was a shitty coach in my 20s. I was a really great assistant coach, which being an assistant coach is about relating to the guys 1 through 12. And, you know, you, as the head coach, there's always tension with playing time and starting and all of that. As an assistant coach, you're just there to support. But when I became a head coach, I really sort of took, unfortunately, that model of someone like a Bob Knight, the little general, right, where you're in charge and the players doing what you tell them is the most important thing, which is not the right way to coach, in my opinion. And it's amazing that since the 80s, Coach Jackson, Coach Phil Jackson, had been successful at every single level where he coached, every single league where he coached, winning championships in I think it was like the Puerto Rican League, and winning championships in what was the precursor to the G League? The CBA, winning championships in Albany with the CBA. And it was really Jerry Krause advocating for Coach Jackson that I think, absent that, I don't think Phil Jackson really had a path into the NBA as a coach, and of course is the most successful NBA coach of all time. But we haven't celebrated, and we don't celebrate enough that model. It's changing now, thankfully, but he was doing this in the 80s. And so I kind of patterned myself after someone like a Bob Knight, where it was, I call it the obedience model of coaching, where the players being obedient, doing what you say is most important. And that's just a fucked up way to coach, and it's a fucked up way to establish relationships. And, you know, the great irony, and this is what the book is about, when I stopped focusing on wins and losses, when I stopped just burning with that competitive whatever it takes to win, and I started focusing on relationships, I won more than I ever had.
So, you know, this all rings true to me as well, because I had a similar epiphany, and I was lucky that I grew up in Chicago and had Phil Jackson to sort of model what we were looking for to some degree, although we never really had, you know, a lot of glimpses into the practices and how that was, you know, how it went, you know, on a day-to-day basis and how that ends up working. But there's two different kind of approaches here, because I don't know if Phil actually mastered, honestly, the communication part on the court as well as he would have liked to have. I think what we're talking about, preparation and like the mindfulness that Phil Jackson practiced, I think that he was unparalleled and way ahead of his game from we're talking about practicing meditation during the games and yoga and those things. But then there's also the actual communication aspect of this, which is what I get yelled at a lot now when I try to espouse a player focused, version of coaching. People will call you soft. They think that's just soft, and they have to be positive all the time, and that's all that is. So what was your take on that evolution, and was that difficult for you to let go of, I suppose, your ego and your need to control things, which is what most coaches, I think, have? How difficult was that to make that switch, and was it overnight? Was it like a snap of the fingers, or was it harder and took longer?
Right. Great couple of questions. So what really helped me is, so I'd been an assistant coach, public high school in Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta, Simmons High School in Hollandale. We won a state championship my first year there. And the legendary coach there, who retired as the all-time winningest boys and girls coach in Mississippi high school history, a guy named George Willis, was very much that traditional model of coaching, right? Curse the guys out. Now, he was incredibly funny, and he would sort of lace his criticisms and even his cursing in these incredible witticisms. So what I took from that, unfortunately, was you have to be tough, you have to curse the guys out. And I sort of missed the softer side of Mr. Willis, which was the relationships he'd built over years and years. And so I was a head coach for 1 year in Mississippi high school, public school, and we finished 10-13, not terrible. But the season was a failure, and I was that little general coach. And then I took a long break from coaching. I got hired by the University of Mississippi to run a teacher training program, and then I went overseas to Namibia and was teaching at a high school there and then a university there. And it was only in my late 30s that I went back to coaching. And then I used everything I had learned about education, about how people learn, how they perform at their best, when I got my PhD, and just my life changes. I've gotten into meditation. Phil Jackson was an inspiration for that, and had become a much calmer, more centered person.
And I'd read the research about how meditation was supercharging learning in all different arenas. And so when I started coaching, then I implemented those things. And it was still a process through that first year. Even though we went undefeated, it was a high school team I was coaching in Namibia. We went undefeated in the regular season, made it to the championship game, city championship, and then lost a heartbreaker. And then what really the book is about is we took the guys on that team and started our own professional team in the professional league in Namibia. And that's really when it was team-led huddles. I'm going to sit down and not say anything during the game, in meditation before every practice, before every game. In the playoffs, we actually meditated in a key game. We meditated in front of everybody, in front of all the people in the stands, right before the start of the fourth quarter. And people were like, you are crazy. And same thing as what you're saying. The sort of alpha dog of the alpha of the league is a guy named Allen, sort of like the LeBron James of Namibian basketball, just a great all-around player, but very much that sort of aggressive, you know, I'm going to sort of poke at you mindset. And he would walk in and see us and he'd say, hey, deep breath in, deep breath out. And it didn't bother me at all because I loved being known as the coach who meditated because I know how powerful it is. Now, the thing is, to your question, Nick, doing this in the States just without having built up any cachet with parents, with the community, with administrators, it looks so different that I don't know if I could have been successful if I'd come into a new community, say, as a high school coach, hadn't built up any of the relationships and just said, okay, I'm not going to say anything during the games. I'm not going to stand up during the games. I may not call timeout during the game. We're going to let the guys or the players run the huddle. It's very tough because there's so much pressure from the outside forces, especially parents who grew up, were likely coached a certain way, think you should coach a certain way, and don't understand why this way is so much better.
So I had, stirred the pot a little bit a couple of years ago after seeing Tom Izzo lose his shit on Aaron Henry in a huddle in the middle of an NCAA tournament game. And, I got a lot of people who, obviously the people who liked the tweet, were supporting me, I imagine. But then there's a lot of hate as well. And I kind of feel like that's sort of the poster child of what we're talking about, the Bobby Knight style, the kind of what I like to come at it now is when I talk to coaches is you need to have a goal with every interaction that you have. And if you have a goal, it's almost like that meditative mind where you're not going to just lose your shit like you see him do all the time in these games. Now, what I would always say is that he's an expert in rebuilding the relationship after he destroys it with these tirades every single time. But it's kind of like abuse in some respects. And it's not often easy to try and explain that to people who then are yelling at you in that same manner that the coach is yelling at the player and using the same tactics, unironically, to like try and criticize you and tell you how bad of a person you are. But I love that idea that like because you yourself meditate, that stuff doesn't bother you anyway. And then in turn doesn't bother the players. By the way, huge respect. I had always envisioned doing meditation and breathing in huddles. And I just never had the guts to do it when I was, the assistant or whatever. I always thought because I would see some of my players hyperventilating in the huddles, right? Literally hyperventilating and their foot is tapping, really, the heels tapping up and down as fast as they can. And they're just, it's insane. And the fact that they could even perform at all, it was amazing in that state. So I really do feel like that is above and beyond. Like I don't think you've heard anybody in America right now doing meditation during games, right? Have you heard about that at all?
No. Let's give a shout out to LeBron James. So he had his first season in Miami. Of course, he kind of had a quote-unquote meltdown in the finals. And then the next year, so now there's all this pressure. Is LeBron with this super team going to win? And in the finals, there were some shots of him in timeouts on the bench meditating. So he really, in addition to Coach Jackson, LeBron James really did a lot to normalize using meditation as a tool for athletes. But you're 100% right. I don't read about or see coaches, especially in the NBA, doing that. And when you were talking about we were talking team-led huddles, to my memory, there are three instances of team-led huddles in the past 10, 20 years. Greg Popovich did it, Steve Kerr did it, and Phil Jackson did it. Mm-hmm. And those are all championship-winning coaches. So you have to build up so much credibility before media, fans, you know, team governors and personnel are going to accept something like this, even though the most successful coaches and teams have shown the effectiveness. And so to your point about Tom Izzo, to parents out there listening, or to anybody out there listening, let's say you have a son at the Michigan State University and calls you up playing for Tom Izzo and calls you up and says, coach called me a motherfucker and, you know, told me to run sprints and do push-ups and I had to get up early and run hills. Yep, tough it out. That's what it's about. Now your same child calls you and says, I was in my econ class and I was 5 minutes late and the professor called me an MF for this and an MF for that and told me to do 20 push-ups before I take my seat. That same parent would be on the phone to the administration of Michigan State saying, what is your professor doing? We don't accept that type of interaction in any other domain in life except probably the military and sports. And there's probably some research that needs to be done there, right?
Well, no way, the military has gone away from this because of that research. Yeah. So not even the military anymore does it that way.
You see? And so let's dive into this. I know this is important to you, which is, how do we perform at our best? And again, for everybody listening, if you think about a high stakes time in your life, whether it's sports or life or job or whatever, where you really performed well, I bet it was you felt the combination of two things. You felt prepared for whatever it was, you had the skill set to deal with it, and you felt relaxed. And the combination of preparation and relaxation, that's what gets you into flow state. That's what gets you into being able to handle a high stakes situation at your best. And the model that we're talking about, the traditional model, is very much preparation, but it's also high stress. I'm going to stress you all the time, and you're not going to have that relaxed feeling in key moments.
Well, and it goes back to that goal, right? So whenever I talk to coaches, I ask them, well, what is a coach's goal during a game? And it's unfortunate that it's too vague of a question because there's a lot of answers to that. But usually what I want to hear is that the goal of the coach during a game is to get the players to play as well as they possibly can. Now, if you can accept that premise, and most coaches would be like, yeah, sure, that sounds good. Well, then if you combine that with what you just said about flow state and how we understand that if you're in a positive frame of mind, you can unlock the most production you can out of a player. Then you would, and also if you understand what the research says about how athletes respond in the face of anger and disgust, then you would never ever detonate on a player in the middle of the game. Now, if you feel like you need to be vociferous in a practice where there isn't, you know, the game on the line, okay, it's a little bit different. But I think that the pushback I get, because a lot of times you'll hear, I need that kind of coaching to play as well as I can. It breaks my heart. And I would say it over and over again. And by the way, the most vociferous people on Twitter during that time were women and girls volleyball players. They would come in there. They would slide into my mentions calling me terrible words and saying soft and this and that, whatever. My take on that really quickly is that I think that there might be more commonly men coaches for girls volleyball.
Right.
And they
right.
want to sort of go overboard because they want to maybe make these girls tougher than they would normally be. And then the girls absorb that. But it breaks my heart to hear players say that, because all it tells me is that they've never had a coach who practices what I call emotional intelligence. And if they had that coach, they would realize in a second, kind of like when we run the triangle offense when I coached, like once you play in an offense like that, like you kind of never want to play in anything else. And the Lakers proved that by getting rid of Tom Jonovich and bringing Phil Jackson back, primarily because they recognized how great the triangle was. So anyway, that's heartbreaking when you have to deal with people who have been like basically abused as athletes, don't even know it, and seem to want it to be able to play well. It's so ridiculous.
Right, 100% agree. I lived and taught in the Mississippi Delta, where corporal punishment is still legal and is still used. And it's the thing of people who grow up in an abusive system generally don't see anything wrong with that abuse, and so they perpetuate it. I mean, it's a horrible thing that happens with trauma and abuse. And so, hey, I got whoopings, or I got paddled by the principal. I got whoopings at home, or I got paddled by the principal at school, or both, and I turned out okay. And I whoop my kids, and I expect the principal to paddle my kids at school. Rather than understanding everything that we've just talked about and what helps people be their best. And if we go back to performance in sports, and to your key question, I think it's the most important question. Like, what is your job as a coach, right? My job as a coach outside the game, outside the competition, is to build positive relationships, and hopefully my players help me be a better person, and I help my players be better people. My job during the game is to lower the stress. There's already so much stress around competition, and then especially once we get in the playoffs, and you know, in Namibia, the playoff games were televised, the stands are packed, but whatever level, you always have people invested, and so that already creates a stressful atmosphere. And then, you know, we have to win, it's win or lose. So my job, and I think the right perception of a coach should, their job is to lower the stress and allow the atmosphere for people to perform at their best. Doesn't mean you're going to win every game, of course, but you're going to give yourself a better chance to win the game.
Now, and it's so true. And also, you have to accept the fact that the perspective that you have as a coach on the bench is a, kind of a lousy one. It's not easy to see exactly what's happening on the court. And so the Izzo example was he was really mad that Aaron Henry screwed up a defensive assignment. And I went back and watched every second of that the second half unfold up until the point where he explodes, and he didn't do anything. What he might have seen or what it perceived was his own thing, but it wasn't really what happened. And so when you see Aaron Henry come back to the huddle completely mystified and then completely off his game for the next 10 minutes because of what Izzo did, it's like that's another thing that you need to recognize, that you have to let go a lot more than you think that, you know, that a lot of coaches are willing to do. I had a four-part series on YouTube, I don't know if you saw it, like probably a year ago, with Alan Keane and Mark Bennett, who have developed exactly this kind of system that you're talking about. And it's actually a whole thing that they're trying to mentor more people. The one thing that they said that I thought would never go over very well in the States, because they're based in England, would be every practice they have the players rate the coach and tell him how he did in that practice. And I'm trying to picture most coaches in America, and the reason why I say that is because I would never have wanted that. I would have been like, oh my God, I'm not going to let them tell me how I did. I did great, you know. But that is such an important part of their method, and it's so empowering to the players that you know, we talk about that trust. The coach needs to have in the player to do what he wants him to do. Well, guess what? That trust is really the opposite. The player needs to trust the coach, right?
100%. Is your goal to lead the team, or is your goal to create the atmosphere and the environment where the team and the players lead themselves? And if you're a coach listening to this right now and you're thinking, you know what, my goal is to lead the team, what is the impulse behind that? Is it because it's going to give you the greatest chance for success, or is it about you? Is it about your ego, right? I want to be seen as the person in charge. I want to be seen by all the fans and parents and whoever in the stands. Hey, that guy's the leader. But I think, and we agree, and these, I didn't see the series from the coaches in England, but 100% agree with that, that the goal is to create the environment and the parameters where, in the ideal situation, if you didn't show up for the game, the team would still perform as it is. They don't need you. You're creating the environment for them to perform at their best. As a teacher, every semester, I gave an anonymous Google form that all the students had to complete in class, because I crave that feedback. And as coaches, we see the importance of feedback, of giving feedback. And to your point about practice, I just want to be clear. It wasn't like I was sitting around letting what happened in practice happen. My practices were scripted to the minute. And the more I took my hands off the wheel in games, the more practices were incredibly structured and constant feedback and constant, you know, if we talk about learning and how people learn, everybody's always doing something, which is something positive I took away from Bob Knight when I attended his coaching clinic at Texas Tech, that there was never any moment where every player wasn't doing something. And, you know, if we just think about a layup line, right, 90% of a layup line is just standing and waiting. So you always want to maximize everybody always doing something. But the goal as a coach should be to build positive relationships and reduce stress. And if it's something else other than that, I think there's ego involved. I've never seen a coach, 90% of the time when a coach loses their shit like Izzo did, it's not performance. It's just because they're losing their shit. And they'll always say, no, that's just, that was calculated. I did that on purpose. 90% of the time, they're just losing. They're angry about something and they can't control their emotions.
Oh, they had to hold him back from perhaps punching the kid. He had a bald fist. He lunges at him. I mean, this was not anything in control, and that happens a lot. And then, of course, whenever they win a game, from that point on, these Michigan State fans will flood my timeline and my mentions with, see, whatever it works. Now, listen, he's produced more NBA players than almost any other program in the time he's been at Michigan State. He's a great recruiter. He gets great athletes. He's got good X's and O's. That's why he wins. It has nothing to do with the fact that he's an asshole and screaming and yelling at these guys all the time. It's actually the fundamentals that he does sneak in there in between. I think that a lot of coaches also talk about buy-in, and they lament every year how they don't get buy-in and they get enough buy-in. And I just want to give them a hug and tell them, like, you're always going to complain about this unless you realize that you need to move halfway in the player's direction. And what I mentioned earlier about trust is, like, so, you know, obviously you get playing time because you trust this guy is going to do what you want him to do, but then the player needs to trust that you have his best interest at heart as well. And there's no better way to do that than, like, certainly in practices, actually working on the individual skills that will get a player better. And I think that that's another big revolution in the last, 20 years. I know when I was structuring my practices, and I think you mentioned this in the book as well, we didn't do a lot of individual stuff. We can't waste time. That's your time. You have to do it on your own. We need to get into our five-man offense, defense, press, press break, out-of-bounds plays. Turns out, I mean, now what I do is I would spend half of my practice on all the individual skills because none of that fancy-schmancy offense works real well if the players can't actually score or dribble or shoot, And I think that that's, you made that realization as well, and you talk about it in the book, right?
Yeah, 100%. And since this is a coaching-specific, basketball-specific podcast, let me throw one thing out there. So one drill that I started using, I kind of combined a couple different things. It's all the players are lined up 2x2 facing each other about 10, 15 feet apart. It's a passing drill, right? So you're going to have the ball, you're going to pass fake, and then pass. And then once you pass, you're going to close out on the person you just passed to. You're going to force them left, and they're going to dribble. And then once they pick their dribble up, you're going to yell, dead, 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 and play aggressive defense. So now you're working, and while you're pass faking before you pass, the other player V cuts. So now you're working V cutting, pass faking, passing, closing out, forcing left, dribbling for the other player, and then defensive stance and dead, 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 and communication. And so being able to combine, that's the superpower for coaches out there. Combine multiple different, use your creative side to come up with drills that combine several different parts of fundamental basketball, offense and defense. And then, so we have a row, let's say if we have 20 players, 10 guys all doing this at the same time. And I'm just walking around, checking form, giving feedback, et cetera. But everybody's doing something, and both players are working on a specific skill, on multiple specific skills. That, because at the end of the day, you got 2 hours. After 2 hours, everybody's brain is mush. They're not going to learn anything new. So the mark of a great coach is, how efficient are you in those 2 hours? If I'm more efficient than someone else, my team is likely going to be better.
Now, the other complaint besides buy-in is, I never have enough time in my practices. And then you realize that they're spending 25 minutes of their practice running suicides.
Exactly.
And this is the other thing we talked about. Because, Brian McCormick, shout out to him, best friend of The Breakdown, has a couple books, Fake Fundamentals, Volume 1 and Volume 2. I mean, I was even talking to somebody somewhat recently who I respect as a coach, thinks, and I'm pretty sure he's really pretty cutting edge on a lot of things, was like enamored with a three-man weave. And I'm like, well, there is, why would you want to train your players to throw like 40-foot passes across the middle of the court and then kind of follow that pass all the way around? I mean, they used to run a weave in the half court in a much smaller area, and that would be something, but not as a full court drill. But of course, he must have learned it, and the person before him learned it, and that's what he thinks needs to be done. And so obviously the other take on that is, okay, if you really want them to be in shape, well, then design a drill where they are not only running quickly, and then maybe there's a time limit to it, but then they're also dribbling perhaps and catching, doing all those things. But that actually simulates what happens in a real game. We'll get into like small-sided games in a minute, I suspect, is what we're going toward in part whole method. But it really is amazing to me how, like, maybe it's uncreative is the word for coaches. I love to just invent drills on the spot. Yes. Sometimes. Just invent a drill, have it be creative, and then figure out a way to solve a problem that that specific team has. Does it feel to you like there's a reluctance to do that?
Yeah, well, it goes back to how people were coached. But let's dive. I'm curious now. Let's dive into that, Nick. So creating drills, if we come up with a framework for doing that, hopefully it should work more than one skill set. And it's the kind of drill where everybody on the team can be doing it at once. You know, that's one thing I'd love to see coaches get away from is there's so much standing around in practice. Whereas ideally, going back to efficient use of time, you always want everybody hopefully doing something. So, you know, I think for coaches out there, using your creative brain, come up with effective drills. I think two things to think about initially are, what's a drill that's going to combine multiple different fundamentals for both players in the drill, or how many players are in the drill, and can it be something that everybody can be doing? So it's two people, three people, four people, whatever it is, but just space out around the court and we're going to work on these several different things. Now the advanced level, right, is the more fundamentals you can jam in that drill, or especially small-sided games, that's really where I was going my last year as a coach, then the more reps guys are going to have. And to your point, you want it in game-like situations. When in a game is someone going to do a three-man weave or do a suicide?
Right. Well, especially because, and it usually shuts them up pretty quickly when I say, there's nothing about running in a straight line back and forth at a predetermined distance and a predetermined time that resembles basketball at all. You know, you might as well, you know, go and, you know, go running on the beach and like play volleyball. You know, there's nothing that connects that. I would love to figure out, maybe that's a 30 for 30, the history, the origin of the suicide. Because right. I feel like I've seen footage of people doing that running drill, you know, in the 40s. So somebody came up with it. Hey, we'll touch every line or whatever. But like, you know, Hoosier style. You end up realizing that we're talking about efficiency. I mean, listen, you want to go into one of my pet peeves, diving on the floor for a loose ball.
Now, the injury risk.
Well, that. But here's the other thing. The worst place you can possibly be in on the floor, the worst position you can be in the basketball court is on the ground with the ball. You can't do anything. It's going to be a travel. It's a jump ball. They smother you. They steal it from you, whatever. Maybe you get the pass every once in a while. But also, in a number of instances, scooping the ball up and getting a layup is a possibility versus a zero possibility of doing that if you just dive on the ball. You're never going to get that. So why wouldn't you increase the possibility of you scoring, getting an easy bucket? And again, it's unimaginative on the parts of people who scream at me for this because they think, oh, it gets my team, you know, really jacked up and they're really, you know, inspired by that. But I would think it'd be a lot more inspiring to see a guy who had been trained to run sort of doubled over like a third baseman going after a slow roller. No one's trained this. That's why no one's faster on running like that. But that would get my bench up if we had trained that, and he just, even better, the guy gets there first as a diver and gets in and he's on his back with the ball, and my guy just gallops right through and rips it out of his hands and then goes in and gets the layup. That is inspiring. Not getting to the worst position you can be in on the basketball court, but like, again, it's a really difficult to get that through and have people release whatever that is they think is perhaps toxic masculinity and this notion of fake hustle that we see sometimes. You know, that's the kind of stuff. I mean, do you have any things like that that are out of the box that you've encountered that that kind of fly in the face of everybody?
Sure. So kind of the overarching theme maybe this conversation is questioning assumptions, right? And that's part of getting feedback is once you start getting honest feedback, you have to start questioning some of your assumptions. So why is it that we celebrate that, like diving on the floor for the loose ball, which generally I liked when my guys did because it's hustle, right? And just thinking out loud, that's why I like it because it's demonstrating hustle. But a more effective play would be exactly what you're talking about, hustle and get the ball and scoop it up and go for a layup. So for coaches out there that are, you know, starting to question some of this stuff, I think one helpful tool or thought is go to what the assumption is, and then that's what you want to celebrate, right? So the assumption there is that's showing hustle. Well, hustle's good, right? We want to celebrate that, but it's diving on the floor for a loose ball, the most effective demonstration of hustle? No, what you just described is much better. So an example that I did is we just stopped doing taking the charge drills because the injury risk was just too high. Somebody's going to break their wrist or something taking the charge. Even though I love taking a charge because it gets you possession, guaranteed possession of the ball, and it gets the other team in foul trouble. But it just doesn't seem worth it in terms of the injury risk. So maybe that's something that I did that was a little bit different.
For sure. And even still, you could like want your players to take charges, but you don't need to actually do a charge drill. You might exactly. want them to dive on certain times, but you don't need to waste your time doing the diving drills. That Shaka Smart drill is preposterous to me. With, you know, they have them, you know, that drill, they throw the ball out, and he's got to like save it on the sideline, then he's got to dive for it and slide across the thing, and then he's got to, whatever it was, it's like this fake, it's all fake hustle all the way through. And yeah, even the diving stuff with the injury stuff is there, and it certainly is
well,
a thing.
Well, is it, Coach, is it fake hustle, or is it real hustle deployed badly?
Misplaced hustle.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Misplaced energy. Like I shared a thing on Twitter the other night with Marcus Smart, who, you know, I tend to point out he drives me nuts when I watch him play, but he's out there, he's trying to play defense in the backcourt and then ends up just gambling, is like up in the air, falls across step and like ends up fouling him. Oh no, ends up landing on the ground so badly that like it's a 5-on-4 and they get a wide open 3-pointer. So right. Here's a guy who like thinks he's, you know, giving out energy and this is great, but he pulled himself so far out of position and he was so out of control in doing it that you just give up the opposite of what he thinks he's doing. That is my always been my concern. And the reason why is because like I played that way. I was that kid who had smoke coming out of his ears and thought I had to play 200% harder than everybody else. And really what I was doing was I wasn't being taught individual skills enough. So I thought I needed to overcome that by like hustle versus why not just spend more time and have more efficiently time getting better on skills, you know? And that's right. why I coach, I think, is because I got pretty good. I could have played like D3, but I never had a guy. I had everything I learned was just like through almost like luck because the way that was things were taught were so bad. And like the way I teach it now is so opposite to that it's like I'm desperate to give somebody else who is in my position, you know, as a 10-year-old, the actual sentences that would help, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what's so great, like to your point about the series you did with the guys from England. And I just interviewed for my podcast a coach, the head coach at Denison University, a guy named Chris Sullivan. And he was talking about that they send 5 guys to the offensive glass, which blew my mind. And he walks through kind of how that actually doesn't translate into more fast breaks for the other team because you're forcing them to box out. But he said he got that from watching a YouTube clip from a coach in Australia. So the beautiful thing about today is things are iterating so much faster than when you and I grew up. You know, what you're describing, it's sort of like Plato's cave or the Matrix, right? Like every now and again, you get a glimpse of, hey, there's yeah. something there, right? And then you get a glimpse of something else and eventually you start putting them together. But now that process is happening so much faster. And actually, the coach at Denison, Chris Sullivan, his father directs a program, a master's program in education focused on positive coaching at the University of Missouri. And so there are these things that are popping up, the Positive Coaching Alliance, a guy named Greg Graber, who's great out of Memphis, who does works with a bunch of different college programs, of understanding how things like mindfulness, like meditation, and positive coaching, all these things are incredibly powerful tools, both for performance, right? The more I embrace these, the more I won, but much more importantly for what's important in life, right? And you kind of alluded to this, like the language we use around sports, suicides, the Raiders, going to battle. Like sports should be about play. And I grew up as an incredibly competitive person, an incredibly competitive young man. And it's not the healthiest way to be. And again, this is the whole theme of the book. The less I focused on that, the more I won.
Right. I mean, that's the point, because we talk about like toughness, right? That we're running suicides, so they can be tougher. To me, what toughness is knowing that you're more skilled than the other team and you're going to execute better than the other team. That's always been tough. You know, the best players, if you watch them, they're never on the floor. right? They're never on the floor like diving. And part of the reason why you'd see diving is because you're deficient in skills, and then you need to overcome that somehow. I mean, I have now one hip replacement, another on the way, and my hip replacement was at 37. This finger will never straighten. I mean, just the kind of what we were modeled, like the Larry Bird style. If you can walk, then you need to be able to play. We have to look at a bigger picture here, which is A, you know, you want to have a positive experience. And by the way, again, it's not easy. If you're a high school varsity basketball coach and you have 12 guys on the team and your 12th guy doesn't play, like, he might hate you for the rest of his life, right? That could right. happen. Right. But there are ways to engage everybody in a way that it does feel like, you know, they are part of the team and they're not alienated and they don't hate you for the rest of their life. But like, that's the bigger picture here versus, you know, what you described as far as using war, you know, analogies and metaphors to ultimately not play your best. I mean, I think that's the thing. You're not going to play your best anyway. You're going to play some right. version of something that can get, you know, you can get 80 or 5% about what you can do. But we all know that feeling, even if it's pickup or whatever, of having that rhythm in maybe your favorite song in your head playing to the point where if I were going to run another team again, I would probably have people always like to play music. Oh, we're really forward thinking. We play music while we're warming up. Aren't we cool? Aren't we whatever? I would probably play music during the actual scrimmages. Loud to tap into that, because like you said, like during your games, you know, and we have a model of that in what's in Iowa, what's the team that runs the they sub five out into the time and they score 150
points. The platoon.
Grinnell. Yeah, they platoon and the coach sits at the other end of the bench and just doesn't do anything because everything has been predetermined. So you know, there would be no need necessarily to like be talking too much during scrimmages unless you want to micromanage everything that happens in a scrimmage. But anyway, the point being that tapping into that rhythm, I think, is what you can unlock even more than they'd ever be able to achieve. Versus, I think my mindset back in the caveman days was, I'm going to teach them how to unlock that by making them run 10 suicides this instead of 9. You know what I mean?
Right. And that's going to get them to focus.
Yeah, but that's going to get them to learn. Oh, you could see how much more you could do. You know, like right. that's going to open right. up this other world. And in fact, it just, they're not getting better, right? And so, you know, let's talk about this for a second. Have you been monitoring the Ben Simmons situation?
Yeah, actually, I have two questions for you, and then let's definitely talk about that. So two questions for you. If you went back to coaching, how would you start practice, and what would these, like, percent breakdown of what you did in practice be?
Wow, that's a great question. Because at one point I had an assistant come in with me to coach, and he was like, we have to do these exact same drills, warm-ups, every single day, every single time. It'll be like, you know, it'll give them a sense of normalcy, every, you know, whatever, and it's tumultuous, whatever. And I was like, okay, and we did it, but it was just so boring after the first, like, 5 days. I'm that guy who wants to be constantly changing things up and giving them different things. So, you know, I would probably have, you know, a couple things to get warmed up that I could rotate through as far as warm. But obviously, warm-up is a big thing. And, like, I, you know, a lot of times coaches don't even recognize how important, like, hip flexibility is and you know, core strength. You know, you can become a much better basketball player simply by working on your hip flexibility and your core strength and your glutes. Yep. You know what I mean?
Just dynamic stretching.
Without even touching the basketball, you can get better. So obviously, you know, those are the things. But then, you know, I would definitely spend the first half of the practice. If it's an hour, then let it be an hour of individual instruction. But it would all be small-sided games. And here's the kicker, which I didn't do enough of. So I would do – when I built my triangle offense – and by the way, this is not an interview anymore. We'll ever have a conversation. That's what the whole channel is about, right? So forgive me if I'm talking as much as I am. But
no, this is great.
Yeah, but let's get to this. So I would do 2-line drills, 3-line drills, no defense. I wanted them to get bored with the pattern so they would master the triangle offense. But one day I was like in a hurry. I'm like, okay, we had a 3-line drill going. Okay, now this, the first three are on defense, the next three on offense, and then we rotate offense, defense, defense, rotates. And it was the best practice we had ever. But I didn't do it again. Like, but I'll never forget it. I remember which gym we were in and why. And it didn't dawn on me until like a year later. I was like, the reason why is because not only were we working on our patterns in a small sided game, but it was actually live. And maybe you let them do the first pass to get going, but then it becomes live. And the improvement level on an individual and team basis just skyrocketed. And I was convinced that for years, my teams would always start out kind of slow. And then they'd get warmed up, and then we'd catch on. And I kind of feel like it was because I didn't do enough live action drilling of those lines and of other drills too. So I think that would be my main thing, is to find as many opportunities to have live small-sided drills. I don't care if it's messy. I don't care if the ball gets thrown over and people are flying all over the place. You know, I think that's the other fear is coaches will say, oh, if Bobby Knight walks in right now and they'll see these lines are not perfectly neat and the drill is not run perfectly and he's going to, you know, walk out. I don't care. I want it to be messy. That's the chaos where they learn. So I think I'd be a lot less concerned with all that order, and I'd be a lot more focused on getting as many reps with live defense as I could.
I love it. I love it. So where I go with that is I would, if my last year, my final year coaching, I really got into small-sided games. And the same thing that you're talking about, something that we're both talking about, that like you see these glimpses and it's like, okay, next time let's do this, next time let's do this. And then I stopped coaching in 2017 was my last year coaching, 2017. So if I go back to coaching, it would be meditation to start with, just going to sit in a circle, meditate. One thing that I liked a lot is usually I would have the guys just pair off and somebody who wasn't their bestie and say, just share something, you know, just 2 minutes, share something going on in your life, right? So meditation, share something, stretching, and then maybe 5-10 minutes of just movements without the ball, pivoting, pass faking, shooting form. And then I would do a ton of shooting, like just shots up, form, shooting, da 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 da. And then if it's 2 hour practice, at least an hour, the final hour, maybe hour 15, is small sided games. And what I got into was it could be 3-on-3, 4-on-4, whatever. It's half court. So everybody on the team can participate the whole time. And it'd be really quick games, maybe to 3 points or 5 points. And after the shot goes up, if it's make or miss, everybody has to go back to half court. So it's forcing everybody to sprint to half court and then sprint. If you're on offense and you're fast enough, then you get a free layup. So it's forcing everybody to get back on defense, as it were. And then from there, I added a bunch of little twists. Like if you get fouled and hit the shot, the game's over, right? So now it's really focusing on shot faking and getting fouled. If you shoot a mid-range shot, maybe it's 1 point, but a layup's 2 points and a three-pointer is 4 points or whatever. You can just adjust everything to emphasize. Maybe there's no dribbling. And so that's what I would really – and another key for that is you can't guard the man who's guarding you, right? So the shot goes up. Oh. The defensive team gets a rebound. Everybody on the team now has to get to half court and touch half court before they can be on offense. Everybody on defense has to do the same thing, but – defense can't guard the same guy. So now it's forcing communication. But small-sided games, everybody's invested. Everybody's having fun, right? Because it's play. Let's emphasize that. It's play. And everybody's learning in the chaos.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Obviously, shooting, I didn't mention that. I think the one thing I would change with my shooting was I would do a very little form shooting, at the high school level at least.
Tell me why.
Because I want some version of defense, of visual perception of defense when they're shooting, right. Even if it's just like a little bit, a guy kind of, you know, nearby, but letting him kind of shoot in it, but then ramping it up from there or varying it. I feel like I had too many people who would email me saying I can nail every shot in practice and I get in these games and I can't do it. I think part of it is just because they're shooting without anybody near them and they're just standing and shooting. So I would do as much of that kind of movement into shooting as I could, not just standing around and shooting 10 shots in a row at the same spot, and certainly not with any, and there needs to be some visual disruption of you know, of your field when you're shooting, just to train your nervous system to handle the disruption.
I love that. I love that. And the other thing there is, you know, I hate shooting drills where you go get the ball and pass back to your partner, because then that's encoding, okay, after I shoot, I go towards the basket. Whereas at least the way I coach, you know, I want everybody sprinting back on defense, maybe one or two people crashing. So I'd rather set up drills where if we're shooting with a partner, right, you shoot five times, your partner rebounds five times, passes to you. And the way that we could add what you're talking about is, okay, I get the rebound, I pass out to my partner, and then I close out on him. So he has to shoot. And now what would normally happen is the person shooting would go to the basket and pass back. But that encodes, okay, after I shoot, I don't get back on defense. So I would have, you know, maybe you do it three people, right? So there's one person still getting the rebound. They kick out again to the person and close out as they're shooting while the person who kicked out previously goes back under, something like that.
I like that. Here's my problem with all those kind of drills that deal with passing to somebody and then closing out. you are on offense and now you're on defense. It's weird.
Yeah.
And it doesn't
happen. That's basketball though, right? Like you're always like it switches like that. Right?
Yeah, but it's just it never sat well with me. But I do it. I have no a little problem.
No, with it. There's something there. If something's not sitting well with you, there's something there. Yeah. So I'm not saying that this is correct.
Because so I think this obviously the solution would be, and you can add an extra line, so now you have a little bit more of an engagement in the
there
drill
it is.
You know, because really, when you're closing out to someone who's getting a pass from like the top to the wing, right? So that's
right.
Where the pass should be coming from. Again,
exactly.
you want to have the visual stimulus be the same. And so tracking the ball right to left and then going to the left wing or to the right wing, you know, to close out it would probably be a little bit better. And then again, you can have that passing line do something, or at least they're more involved. Because again, you're right. It's death to have, you want these nice clean lines, but you're asking kids or high schoolers or whoever, college players, to like stand still in the middle of a sporting, practice.
It's torture.
Stupid. So,
and I'll share with you and the listeners the best drill I got from Bob Knight, who was a master at efficient practice, right? I mean, there's a reason he won so many games. Now, he was, just in my experience, sitting in the stands with a bunch of coaches, high school coaches, watching him run practice, and he was mic'd up. He was a total asshole to everybody around him, the grad students, the assistants, the women's coach who popped in. I mean, he just had that need to dominate. But he was a genius at organizing practice. And the best drill I got from him, it's called the change drill. So it's 5-on-5, full court, and go back and forth, and then he would yell change, and whoever had the ball has to drop the ball, and now that the offense is now on defense, and the person who's guarding the ball handler picks up the ball, immediately goes into fast break, and you can't guard the person who was guarding you. So it forces you to communicate, I got so-and-so, and it forces that being comfortable in that chaos of, oh shit, there's a turnover, bang, we're immediately going from offense to defense and vice versa.
Yeah, I have a drill for you too I want to mention, because another one of those things where I had learned it, I think I was a manager at Wisconsin under Stu Jackson, and they were running it. And at some point I did it. And here's let's give you the mindset. You know this, but if you're listening, you might not know the mindset of like the caveman coach. And I kind of point to like 1994 as this ground zero where it all like sort of solidified at that moment. Most people who are born after that seem to get it and were kind of easier to deal with. But people like, I'm probably a little older than you, but people my age or older, it's like, it's caveman. So the drill was so good and it was so fun to play that like the players were always like, hey, can we run that drill again? Can we run the drill? And I'm like, well, no, it's not in our practice schedule and that's a whatever. And I was like thinking about it after that, thinking, what am I, crazy? Why would I not run a drill if the players are desperate to run? Because they love it. Like that's exactly what you've been looking for. And the drill is, I'm really stretching this out here to make it suspenseful. It's 4-on-4-on-4, which is great because now you have 12 players all at once involved. And it starts out as 4-on-2. And as soon as the ball crosses half court, the other two guys on defense run into the mid circle and then have to get in and then try and stop, the four-on-two fast break. Meanwhile, the third team has two guys back, stacked on the free throw line under the basket with their other two defenders waiting at the half court out of bounds. So that when the rebound comes and the defense gets it, they start coming across. And then, again, the two guys come into the middle, touch with their feet, and then get into the play. So it's 4-on-2 into 4-on-4, and then back and forth. But here's the genius of it is, you get a point for a score, you get a point for a stop, you get -1 for a turnover, and you get, +1 for a steal. But then the real – what I had fun with was I'm like, okay, if you guys run pinch post, I'll give you a point even if you don't score off of it. So next thing you know, these guys are getting free points by running the offense that I've been trying to get in the run anyway, and they're doing it on their own volition. That was some of my favorite time, and it's live, and it's fast, and it's competitive. And then here's the other problem, though, is the losing two teams generally would do something that the other team doesn't want to do, and you think, okay, there has to be a suicide or two or something, and I don't want to do a suicide. Maybe you can help me solve this. The ideal would be that they do some sort of punishment that the winning team looks at and goes, God damn, I kind of want to do that too. Like they're getting better and I'm not, And I don't know what that is. Maybe you can help me, but that's the only problem because you obviously want to have stakes so that they want to, win.
Right.
Although just winning is usually enough for them, the competitive juices. But
right.
I don't know if you have any thoughts, but that's my favorite drill and the one that I would probably do for like a half an hour at a time in a practice.
I love it. So it's 4-on-2 to 4-on-4 to 4-on-2 to 4-on-4 just infinitely.
Yeah. You just need to have
love
pennies
it.
So you can have the third team color or whatever.
Yeah. And I love it because it's four, again, it's It's emphasizing when you have the advantage, press the advantage. It's emphasizing communication, and it's just fun. So that's a great question, right? Because I'm sure coaches are out there are thinking, okay, if I can't have my guys run suicides or do push-ups, what should they do? So just off the top of my head, you know, have them do two ball dribbling, you know, up and down the sideline two times, right? Or even better, have them do it and they have to sit out while they're doing it. Obviously, they can't be in the drill. They can't be in the 4-on-4-on-4 because now you're emphasizing how much fun it is to do these drills. And if you're doing it, if you have to do two ball dribbling up and down the sideline two times, you're still working on skills and you're still invested in, and you're not being punished, but you're doing something that the other guys don't have to do.
Yeah. You just need to have 16 balls.
Which is not getting, you know, one of the best pieces of advice I ever heard was one ball, like you should have at least the number of balls as you have players. And I actually think you should probably have two for every player because you always want guys to have a ball in their hand and dribbling. And I'm a big fan of two ball dribbling, even three ball dribbling. I'm sure everybody out there knows Don Meyer and all of his stuff. So love it.
By the way, the two ball dribbling could also be done while you're doing lunges across the court because now you're opening up your hips and that's hard, but you're doing something that's worthwhile, but you also need to be dribbling. Do you call it chunking? I remember I've heard that phrase to bundle, you know, multiple skills together, but maybe that's the solution. Two ball dribbling up and down maybe half court and back, but you have to do lunges while you're doing it. Balance. You know, flexibility, all that stuff. So, but that would be hard. You'd be sweating a little bit after that, even half court back.
So for the coaches out there, I think another thought is think of what it is. Like, I love that idea of you get a point if it goes to the post or pinch post. Think of what it is you want the team to do, and then think about how you're emphasizing that in practice and how you're rewarding that in practice. And again, that's why I love small-sided games, because you can adjust the scoring however you want. If there's five passes, get a point. If the five passes with no dribble, you get 2 points. If it goes to the pinch post, you get a point. You know, just by creating the competition and then, you know, creating the scoring system, you're going to reinforce what it is you want the team to do on the court.
Absolutely. And then there's actually a drill that I watched the Warriors run all the time, which incorporates every rotation you'd ever need in the defense. And it's continuous. So there's a line on top. So there is a line. But once you get going, you go through, you know, four or five positions and then you're right back. You know, it's you're going through a loop, going through every position, every rotation. I even did an interview with Ron Adams, which I guess I'll tell. Like, they're supposed to send me some footage. I've been waiting for like a year to get the footage from practice so I could actually like do a video on it, because I don't even have it in my brain. I could see it, but I was like, I need the diagrams. Nonetheless, it's like anything like that where you can have, you know, 10 people, 12 people doing something at the same time. That's why I even love doing just even, you know, my shell drill, which I would have, let's see, I could have up to, you know, 6 people on the perimeter and then 6 defenders. You know, that's 12 people. You know, we won't have that many people left in line to like go through that. There's no question that it always made me, my skin would crawl. Is that the right, whatever that, my hair would stand up, whatever it is, when I would see too many people standing. And even back in the day, right. I'm like, well, this is the drill. I don't know what else to do. This is what we have to do. But it always sat, you know, problematic with me. Yep. Even like dipping on the catch. You know, I was growing up saying, well, if you want to play D1 and be a D1 shooter, you can't dip the ball when you catch it. And I would see like Larry Bird dip it. And I'm like, well, I guess it's because he's 6'9". He's allowed to dip. You know, all those things that never sat well with me from the teaching standpoint. You know, finally, when you have a chance, you can actually experiment and realize that, you know, your instincts are probably right. And then especially when we have, you know, HD footage and frame by frame, we can finally see what these people are really doing. You know, it's like, again, it would be fun to see the history of the suicide, who decided to invent that thing. It's also interesting to see, like, well, who invented, you know, shooting? Why did they feel like that was the way to shoot? And why did they feel like this became dogma for so long? And, you know, I mean, part of the answer is all the shit we learned that's not right is because of two-handed set shots that had started, you know, when we started. And then when they went to one-hander in the late 30s, early 40s, no one thought to, like, update update the method, right? It's
that's
crazy.
That's such a great question, Coach. I've never – but again, if we go back to question and assumptions, that's a huge one. Why do we shoot like this? And is it the most efficient, effective way to shoot? I've never thought about that, but that's the type of thing we're talking about, right? Yeah. Question everything. And if something's bothering you a little bit, there's a – you know, investigate that. And then once you figure out what it is that's bothering you, what it is you want, backwards plan to emphasize that. In practice. Speaking of shooting, you wanted to say something about Ben Simmons?
Oh, well, the Ben Simmons thing, as you know, we can start. This will be the we can wrap this up as we start. Sure. It's, again, this is a dangerous conversation that could go on for like more.
I know,
more hours,
6 hours.
Yeah, so we'll have to like hang out at some point in real life and do this. Without the, I don't know about you, but like my wife, whenever I run into somebody like at a party like that, it's like she starts yanking on me, like let's go. She can't, you know, couldn't. Anyway, the point being that Ben Simmons. So, you know, everyone you talk to, inside, outside, whatever, will tell you that he doesn't work very hard. And he's kind of angry and he's surly and he's aloof and all these different things. And, you know, I might have even gotten that impression, you know, talking to him once or twice, like at a shoot around, whatever. But here's my take, is that he's getting terrible shooting instruction. Of course, he's missing, you know, and this is years of terrible shooting instruction and years of breaking. So I don't blame him for becoming so fed up and frustrated, and like that would make him angry. Like, here's a game he's so good at, but here's one part of it that he's not doing well at. He can't seem to get any better after all these reps and after all these things. So it's like, what's the point at this point? I just kind of give up, and I don't think it's, you know, this is not fun. This is not helping. And as a result, he's now getting painted as that kind of player in a very negative light, when I think it could very well just be that he just hasn't gotten the right coach.
Oh, yeah. Ben Simmons does everything on the floor that helps you win basketball games, right? He scores, he rebounds, he passes. He is a phenomenal defender who can switch 1-5 and can run the team. So he's quite similar to Draymond Green, probably a more athletic, taller Draymond Green, who is an incredible winner. And we preach, and this is important on the court and in life, to know your blind spots, to know what it is you don't excel at, and to accommodate that. Ben Simmons knows he's not a great shooter, and he knows he's not a great three-point shooter. Therefore, he doesn't take three-point shots. That's smart. That's basketball intelligence. I know I don't do this thing well. Let me minimize the number of times I don't do this thing. And instead, the response is, well, you should shoot some fucking threes. Well, he's aware that he doesn't do that well. So he's not doing it. That's a smart basketball player. Now we can get into maybe he should be shooting with his other hand. He's naturally – there's something about maybe he's naturally a left hand, but he does everything right hand or opposite. But whatever it is, he has recognized that he doesn't do this thing well. Therefore, he's minimizing the times he does it, which helps his team win games in addition to everything else he does on the court.
Well, that is true in the regular season. But when you mm-hmm. get into the playoffs and they have time to actually scheme, and then he goes and hides because he doesn't want the ball because they're going to foul him and put him in the free throw line, that mm-hmm. is a problem. And mm-hmm. this penchant for him to just go by, hang up on the dunker spot, which, by the way, I just want to throw this out there since we're talking. That's the slot. Why the slot became out by the, you know, the elbow extended, that's like a bastardization of a term that was supposed to be the dunker spot. I don't even like that term. I don't know what that, you know. It's the slot. It's down by the baseline where he likes to go hang out and then hide. And he'll do that even, you know, not even in the fourth quarter a lot of the time too. That is really the issue, I feel like. Because you're right. Everything you described, he does really well. But we get to these playoff games, and he seems, and it's a mental thing. He gets scared, doesn't really want to be engaged, and so now they're playing like 4-on-5. And then there are times, if he is on the perimeter, where they just sink off of him so low that he gets in the way of everybody else, or his man can. That, you know, that's a first world problem, right? That's a second round of the playoffs right. problem, right?
Right.
But you know, if they want to win a title,
if he's generating positive play after positive play, let's say for the first 36 minutes or the first 38 minutes. He's still helping your team win, right? I mean, the way I think about it is like putting your thumb on the scale. LeBron James and Chris Paul are right now the ultimate thumb on the scale players. They just maximize every possession, even to the with Chris Paul, even to the extent of with the referees. So Ben Simmons does that. You wouldn't throw the ball to Shaq in the final 2 minutes for the same reason. Doesn't mean, you know, he's not a phenomenal player.
That's a great point. And that, by the way, that's the thing with Shaq, is he never had a last second play called for him. Like, this is right. supposed to be the MVP of the league and all these things. And it was like, you know, and by the way, that's what Doc was trying to say. And he ineloquently said it at the end of the playoffs last year, which ultimately cost him a player, like, who's never going to play. I think probably because of what he said. But what was lost was that he said, you know, he just needs to fix the free throws. And that's probably right, because if here's the, I guess the key would be is if he shot free throws better, then he would be more engaged in the offense, coming around handoffs, driving, and kicking, that if they do follow him and he goes to the line, then he can still be a benefit to the team. And by the way, 50% from the free throw line is 1 point per possession. Now, it's a little bit harder to argue that, like, you know, when you need the 2 points and you're down by three or whatever in the last four mm-hmm. minutes. But, you know, there is some leeway to that as well, as far as how bad of a free throw shooter are you before you are really bad. You know, is 60% really that bad when you're going to make, you know, what is that per possession? It's certainly more than 1.0, which is good. So anyway, so Doc probably was more right than not, as far as, you know, focusing on, like, if he could fix the free throw issue, that would go a long way. And you know, and then we have a whole other thing. We talk about free throws and rhythm and shooting, because again, we teach shooting free throws completely different than shooting jump shots, and that makes no sense to me either. A completely different rhythm, a completely different kind of emotion. Why do we have to master two different skill sets for what should arguably be the same? And you know, and that's the other thing. You know, and some players have been able to do it and have been great at it. But you know, you watch Steph Curry; he mimics the rhythm he shoots on a jump shot in his free throw, and that seemed. And so did Steve Kerr and a lot of those guys. So anyway, well, listen. This was awesome. I'm not even sure we got enough into the book, but you guys got to have to buy the book. The link, I'll put it in the description below in the podcast description. But again, the name of the book is Zen and the Art of Coaching Basketball. The writer is Ben Guest, who was my guest in the show today. So, Ben, we'll have to come back on and do this again and maybe get on the court one day and actually do some stuff on video.
I would love to. I'd love to get on the court and, you know, get a high school team in there and you know, just run a bunch of drills and do all that stuff. Would love it. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. Again, the book is Zen in the Art of Coaching Basketball, and it's available on Amazon, ebook, paperback, hardcover. Hardcover edition is great. And on Twitter, I'm B Guest, G-U-E-S-T. So Ben Guest on Twitter, B Guest. And then I have a Substack where I have a weekly podcast interviewing creatives, writers, coaches, sports folks, and that's benbo.substack.com. B-E-N-B-O. That's my family nickname, benbo.substack.com.
Uh-huh. But can Coach, we find it on the podcast app as well? On the Apple podcast? What's it called there?
It's called Conversations About Creativity. Conversations About Creativity. And at the top, I mentioned self-publishing and writing. So I have a bunch of stuff, a bunch of interviews about how to maximize self-publishing. So Zen and the Art of Coaching Basketball actually became the number one book in the category of coaching basketball. And for a day, it was the number one book in the overall basketball category, ahead of Scottie Pippen and Mamba Mentality and so forth. So I have a couple of great interviews. Sorry, I'm in New York, so there's some hammering upstairs. Have some great interviews about the process of self-publishing and how to maximize your sales.
Love it. Well, I'll check all that stuff out. For the love of God, please stop the hammering, to reference Scrooge. And again, thank you so much for being on the show. And don't forget, sports fans, at B-Ball Breakdown, we're not a channel, we're a conversation. You in? Are you in, Ben?
Definitely. Count me in.